will be on.
I feel really bad for you. I feel really bad that I have a meeting at one that I can't change due to recent events on campus. But it's super exciting to see everyone here right before exams. Tomorrow with Rabbi Eli Fisher, who I've known for quite a while since he's the neighbor of a sister in Modi'in. Rabbi Eli was a JOIC educator at Maryland Hillel back in the day. Okay.
Maryland's pretty good.
You've probably read things that Rabbi Fisher has written in the Jewish Review of Books, Mosaic, Haaretz Eli, what do you think? But he makes the news occasionally.
The forward, right?
And occasionally he's in the news, which hopefully he'll talk about given the topic. He'll find a way. Where there's a
renegade wedding? No, that's not going to
happen. Renegade wedding? So without further ado, thank you, Rabbi Fisher, for coming all the way to Waldman from Modi'in to teach us and learn with us.
Happy to be here. It's great to see some familiar faces. As some of you know that, you know, my name Fisher and Yat and Kira are Fishers, and that's not a coincidence. We're cousins. Ezra's also a cousin, so this is a little family reunion going on here. And obviously, it's a week before Yom Ha'atzmaut, and that's actually why I'm in the States right now. Part of this contingent of Israelis who come to the United States before Yom Ha'atzmaut to talk about Israel. If they knew what I actually was going to say, maybe they wouldn't be so keen to send me on these little missions. But it is what it is. I'm one of the bad Meraglim, right? God forbid. I live there, and I love living there, and I wouldn't change that for anything. But the question here is, the last few years, 5-6 years already, I've been working with and for Rabbi Eliezer Melamed, the author of Hanina Halacha, editing his books, and now I also have more of a broader role in terms of promoting his books. And at a certain point, I started to realize that what he's talking about, you know, his books, they're good books, they're well written, they're interesting, they combine hashkafa and halacha, which makes them easier to read, but there's something about them that's more compelling. And he sold, you add up all the different volumes, right, and the sets, and the different languages, it's English, and Russian, and Spanish, and French. If you add it all up, he sold almost a million books of Hanina Halacha in circulation. It's a lot. So there's something that's compelling there. I want to try to explore what that is. And the question, which is really, I mean, it's a question, and it's an interesting question, but it's not such an interesting question. Is there such a thing as a Zionist halacha? So we'll talk about Rav Melamed. We'll discuss what I think he's trying to do. And at the end, if you think that that's what Zionist halacha is, then okay, there's such a thing as Zionist halacha. I don't think there can be a self-consciously Zionist halacha, because halacha has to be... It's like, well, I would think that should be the halacha, but because I'm a Zionist, I have to think otherwise. No, it's never a conscious process. If it's going to be real, it's not going to be a conscious process. So, I want to start with a passage. It's in the handouts. It starts with Hilchot Kashrut Aleph. Hanina Halacha Kashrut Aleph. In Hebrew. Kashrut Aleph, right, there is no Kashrut Bet yet. Working on it. And it hasn't been translated into English. So, one of the things he discusses in there is the mitzvot ha-tluyot ba'aretz, the special mitzvot that pertain to agriculture that grows, was cultivated in the land of Israel. He talks about ma'aser and truma, ma'aser sheni, ma'aser ani. So, those unfamiliar. There's a 7-year cycle, The seventh year is the sabbatical year, the Shemitah year, where the land has to lie fallow. The other 6 years are divided into three smaller cycles of 3 years, where there are three different gifts given from the entire crop, the entire GDP, if you will. A certain percentage, about 3%, goes to the Kohanim, so that it supports their work in the temple, ideally, or other work that they do in terms of teaching. And then about 9% goes to Leviim. And then another about 9% is either Maaser Sheni or Maaser Ani. Two out of the 3 years, the first two of the 3 years, it's Maaser Sheni, which means that it has to be spent, it has to be eaten in Jerusalem or redeemed for money, and that money has to be spent on food in Jerusalem. Or in the third year, every third year, two out of every 7 years, it goes to the poor. About 9% goes to the poor. So this is something that I got a fine education at the Talmudical Academy of Baltimore, so this is something that I learned in high school. It's not that esoteric. But there's a question that just, it never dawned on me, and I don't think there's anyone that really deals with it until Rav Melamed. So Rav Melamed says here, L'chora kasher, this seems difficult, challenging. Madua kav'a ha-Torah la-hafrish b'shanim aleph bet dalet hey ma'aser sheni v'shanim gimel vav ma'aser ani. Why is it that this 9% goes to the poor only on year 3 and year 6, and in years 1, 2, 4, and 5, it goes to ma'aser sheni in Jerusalem? Im ratzta'l odedet ha'aliyah l'regel v'gam la'azra la'ani. If the Torah sees it as important both to encourage pilgrimage to Jerusalem, to, you know, encourage spending in the cultural center, the gam la'azor la'aniim, and also to help aniim. Madua lo tzivta kadosh tzivta lahakdish b'chol shana v'shana shlish l'shlari li'al regel v'shlish l'aniim. We're talking about 9%. So say every year 6% has to be spent in Jerusalem, 3% goes to the poor. Im aniim zekukim l'tosefet ezra. If the poor people need more money, they need more help. But the poor people only need this extra help 2 years out of 7. What are they going to do the other years? Right. So it's a question that it's almost strange that this is. Once the question is asked, it's like what they call in Israel she'elat kitbe. Right. Once you ask the question, it's like, well, of course. Like, it's an obvious question once it's asked. And so he goes on to explain something, which this is his hashkafah, and it's something that you can take or leave. And I think that there's definitely some interesting elements there, and you know whether or not you want to tweak it to fit your economic theory. I think that's fair game. It's clear here that you know what his where he's coming from. Basic subsistence is covered by the other gifts that have to be given to the poor. Leket, shikha, and peah, the stuff that's left over from the harvest, or either intentionally or unintentionally. V'tosefet tzedakah lefi hatzorech, or if there are people that are really in dire straits, give them tzedakah directly. V'yu ha-ma'aser la'ani, but ma'aser ani, no'av la'anik lehem shanim tovot, shebehem yuchlu lehanot mervacha. That's to give them better years. Years where they can have a little bit more breathing room. Right? He uses the term rivacha, which means welfare. I might use the term, meaning if I was writing this, I'm not, he's writing this, I might use the term dignity. Right? They have a more dignified living. Right? And this is, if you look at questions today regarding poverty, there are two basic ways to define poverty. There's a subsistence poverty. Right, there's an argument that you say that the people that are alive today, the poor people that are alive today, have more food and you know they have more things, they have more amenities than even wealthy people had, you know, two generations ago, 100 years ago. You know, they're all getting vaccinated, we hope. that's probably more of a problem amongst the upper class than lower class, people not getting vaccinated. But you know, they have health, they have at least some basic health care. You have, you know, there is a social safety net that's making sure that people, at least in places like the United States, people aren't starving to death. That was a real concern until not long ago. And there are others, so there are some that want to define the poverty line based on that basic subsistence, that if you have what you need, if you have what you need in order to get, if you have the basic subsistence level of living, then you're not poor. And there are others that say no, that it has to be defined based on local standards of wealth, such as the Gini coefficient, right, where the poverty line is defined as 50% of the median income. That if you're making less than half of the median income, then you're defined as poor. So if you're in a very wealthy country, that's going to be relatively high. If you're in a poor country, that's going to be relatively low. But it has nothing to do with actual subsistence. So he's sort of charting the course in between these two, and he's saying, Maser Ani, years 1, 2, 4, and 5, we're going to take the basic subsistence approach. And years 3 and 6, we're going to take the Gini coefficient approach. And then he goes on and says, we can hope that the Daba 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 Daba, if possible. So he's acknowledging that there are some people that are poor because they can help it, and there are some people that are poor because they can't help it. So if it's possible, if they can help it, maybe the more dignified existence that they experience in those 2 years out of 7 will encourage them, will incentivize them to go out and work. And maybe if it doesn't incentivize them, maybe if it doesn't help them, maybe they can't do anything about it. But their kids who are growing up below the poverty line, maybe it'll help their kids and it'll show their kids that they can aspire for something more. So that they can gain their own dignity and independence. But if they would get this basic more than subsistence level every year, then they would get used to that and they wouldn't feel the need to aspire for more. So there has to be this some years basic subsistence, some years something more dignified, in order to preserve this, in order to sort of thread this needle, in order to walk this balance between, on one hand, we don't want people to become too accustomed to receiving handouts, so we want to encourage them to go out and do work on their own, but on the other hand, we want to give them some dignity, and of course, we want to cover basic subsistence. So again, I think that there's room to articulate a different economic model within this structure that he's setting out, but the fact that he's taking what we learn, I learned, I don't know if that's true of everybody here, but I learned as a basic pro forma halacha of, you know, this year you give this much, and this year you give this much, and he's looking at it and he's like, well, clearly the Torah is trying to articulate an economic theory here, and clearly the Torah is trying to teach us something about how society should run from an economic perspective. Okay, so I think that's something that, you know, I start with this example because it shows that this is what he's trying to do when he's learning halacha. He's saying that halacha is not just the pro forma, this is what you do, but it's part of this broader, this is how society should run. This is how we envision what I would call a Torah civilization. I call it a civilizational approach to halacha. That the halacha is the building blocks of a Jewish civilization. Questions so far? We go on. Yeah.
Why then specifically years 3 and 6 and not, like, it seems kind of random, why not 2 and 5, why not?
It could be kind of random. Okay. You know, I don't think there has to be significance to the Again, I don't know what he would answer. What I would answer is that this is related to a Rambam takes this approach, right? That Rambam and the Moreh has an approach where it's really important to have the laws of, for example, the laws of kashrut. It's really important to have a system of laws where, you know, there are certain things that you can eat and certain things that you can't eat. Certain things are kosher, certain things are not kosher. There have to be these boundaries, and that system of boundaries is really important. Which actual species are kosher, which are not, that can be relatively arbitrary, right? That the structure is more important than the detail. So if it could have, you know, years 1 and 4 versus years 3 and 6, okay.
If the reason is to enable the poor to have a higher quality of life, then why give tzedakah in the other years?
Subsistence.
No, I mean, like, if it's not year 3 and 6, what do you do with that money?
With money?
So a person wants to give Meiser, right?
But Meiser Sheni.
Right.
Meiser, in 4 years, it goes to Meiser Sheni, and 1 year, it goes to Meiser Ani.
Right.
These are required. Right. If there's a, and those are, his argument is that those are beyond subsistence, right? That that's so that the poor people can buy a TV, not that they can, you know, buy dinner.
Okay, fine. And the fact that it's also given to Levim.
So it's three different tithes, right? The first amount that's given is the Maser. Every year you have Truma that's given to the Kohanim. Every year you have Maser Rishon, the first tithe, which is given to the Levim. And then it's the third, it's that third stratum that in some years is has to be brought to Jerusalem and consumed there. And in other years is given to the poor. Okay? That's, sorry that I didn't make that clear in the at the beginning.
Yeah. This, these 7 year cycle correspond to Shemitah?
Yeah.
And it's a little fuzzy on Hilchot Shemitah. Is there like any utility in the sixth year that you get something? It's also the year right before Shemitah. Would there be potential utility there? Because I guess people aren't working their fields as much. You don't have access to those other Shechachah Peah, et cetera stuff? Or is that not?
Interesting. I like that. That answers your question. Right, that it would be specifically in the sixth year that you have to give this extra because there's not going to be as much peya, mm-hmm. and there's not going to be as much shikla because people are starting to store up for Shemitah, so they're a lot more, they're a lot less wasteful. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting, I like that. Nice job, guys.
But then by that logic, you shouldn't, like, having it at the, then it's still the same amount of time between the 3 and the 6, and that, like, the third year should be the second year, such that, like, meaning if there isn't as much food that exists because of Shemitah, you're leaving them the same amount of as they have between the years 3 and 6, there's more food available, and there's
right.
less food
so
available
then,
between years 6 and 3.
So if you take this approach, then the Maser Ani in the sixth year isn't actually for subsistence, it isn't actually for welfare, or for, you know, for a more dignified existence, it's to cover
the
subsistence from other years. Good point. Okay. I don't have an answer. This is a good... I like the Shakla Vitaria, either way. There was another question. I think I saw another hand. Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think when, like during Shemitah, all the field become hefker, so wouldn't it almost be the opposite, that during year 6 you wouldn't need to provide as much because anyone's like private crops become hefker, so anyone can come and take
yeah, but
from
you
them.
Can't cultivate it. It's whatever like kind of grows wild.
Okay.
Right. So everybody's kind of living on subsistence during Shemitah.
Okay.
Yeah. So also like
this
year, like loans are forgiven and stuff like that. So people are also less likely to give money to people if they haven't been paid back themselves. So it's good that like in the sixth year, like people are forced to give Maser Ani to support the poor people that they would have been giving out money to otherwise because
yeah.
of the loan forgiveness.
Yeah, and it's the term that you use there, forced to give, he's thinking about this, and I think the Torah really thinks about this as a system of taxation. Like, these are taxes, right? But instead of like lump sum income tax and then the government figures out how to divide it up, it's like, no, this, you first of all, you have the ability to give it to the Kohen that you want, to the lady that you want, to the Ani that you want. I mean, you choose who you give it to. And there's also a, you know, it's divided for you, right? It's, you know, these are the percentages. These are the ratios between what goes to the Kohen, what goes to the Levi, what goes to the Yisrael, to the ani. Okay. Let's move on to another topic that it doesn't at first glance seem to be related. But this was one of the first things that I had ever learned from Avon. Right? About a year after I moved to Israel, we spent the Shabbos in Modi'in. I was like, I don't really know this guy, but people are talking about it. I knew him more for his political stuff than for his halacha writings. Here, okay. I'm going to go hear what this guy has to say. He's interesting. So he gave this shiur about learning on Shabbos. And he came out with this idea that he went through this whole cheshbon. He came out that you have to learn for 6 hours every Shabbos. He says that all of your waking hours should be divided between what's for you, you know, doing for yourself, and doing things for God. So if you figure that everybody's sleeping, let's say, on Shabbos you sleep a little more. So you sleep for 8 hours, then it's 16 hours left. And then of the six, there's 17 hours left. And then if you figure out how much of those, of that time, so you divide it up and it's supposed to be 8 hours for yourself, 8 hours for God. Of those 8 hours for yourself, figure 2.5 hours for davening. So the other 5.5, 6 hours should be for God. Right? It's 8 hours, right, for learning, right? 2.5 hours for davening, 5.5 hours, 6 hours for learning. Okay. And I came away very weirded out by this. Right. It's only,
yeah,
by the way.
So fast. Like,
no, you can count the rabbi's drasha. Okay. Like, one of the questions that I had was, like, if you're, like, reading a sefer during the rabbi's drasha, but listening with half an ear, can you count that
double?
Double. So, but that was the attitude that I was coming up with. Like, I never liked this idea of stopwatch Judaism. You know, I'm like, oh, so I have to do this many hours. I'm like, sitting there with a stopwatch, and I get to my 6 hours? I don't know. And then there's, okay, and it's also very binary, right? It's either you're doing something for God or you're doing something for yourself. What if you're doing something for another person? Right? What if you're part of a family and one spouse takes the kids to the park so that the other spouse can take a nap? What does that count as? Right? I mean, it's like, in life, there's, you know, it's not all one or the other. It's more complicated than that. Life is non-binary. So this, I was troubled by what he's trying to do. You know, what is he trying to do here? Like, why is he, after some conversations, and then, a few years later, he came back to Modi'in. Oh, after we came out with Hilchot Shabbat in English, we did a little book launch in Modi'in, and he came. And so I was in touch with the secretary, and he said, okay, what does Rav Malamud want to talk about? And it was like right before Yom Kippur. I was like, I suggest maybe something, you know, special halachot Shabbat that falls out on Yom Kippur, so it combines them, or tshuva, or, he's like, and the secretary was like, Rav Malamud's going to talk about learning Torah on Shabbat. I was like, well, you know, the last time he was here in Modi'in, that's what he spoke about, maybe he could speak about something else. Nope. That's what he's talking about. Are we sure? Yup. And like, I reached out to, like, I think, I can't remember if it was his son-in-law or one of his close students, and I was like, what's the deal? He's like, that's his thing. Right? He talks about that everywhere. I was like, why is he so, why is he obsessed with this? Like, he insists on, I've only heard him speak like 4 times, and 2 of them were about this. What's the deal? So, it turns out, you know, and you have that in front of you. We're not going to go through the whole text. He goes through the cheshbon, you know, how you get to 6 hours. I realized is that in his vision, during the 6 days of the week, people aren't really learning because he's pro-big families, and he's pro-people going and getting jobs that require higher education and serious investment, and he wants people to get good jobs, And between the commute and taking care of the kids and time at work, there's not a lot of time during the week to really learn. He's also anti-Kollel. Right? He doesn't think that people should be sitting and learning just for to no end, right? To no goal. The idea of Kollel, if somebody is going to become a Jewish educator, a rabbinic leader, then sure, take the time, sit and Kollel, right? The same way that a doctor would go to medical school, so someone that wants to become a member of the Jewish clergy could sit and spend that extra time learning. But in terms of learning without any, you know, that's not geared towards that, he said, well, what makes you so special? Everybody should be doing that. Shabbos becomes his Kollel. Shabbos is the day that, like, everybody should be engaged in serious Torah study. It's not a 1 year or two after you get married, or even three or four after you get married. It's lifelong. You learn your whole life, just one day a week, instead of learning 1 or 2 years after marriage, or in that age range. He thinks that everybody, men and women, should spend a certain amount of time learning during their formative years, right? You have the three basic commitments that he talks about in the ages, you know, post high school. And he's talking to an Israeli audience. So you have preparation for career, and then you have acquiring a serious base in Torah study, and you have military service, at least for the men. And he's very sensitive to that triple commitment. Right? And he wants people to have big families, as I mentioned. So there's a lot of pressure in those formative years. But he doesn't want, let's say, military service and yeshiva and starting a family to undercut the potential development of a career. Right? So he's even, you know, some of the other things that I brought in the source sheet, where he talks about birth control, right? Contraception, and family planning. It's all part of this same calculus where, yes, starting a family is important, but developing a career is also important. So you have this model where he wants people to self-actualize through work. He wants people to contribute to society through their work, which means that they're not going to have a lot of time during the week to learn. Maybe a short halacha shiur after davening, maybe a daf yomi, but in terms of the serious commitment to Torah study that he thinks everybody needs to have, that can only happen on Shabbat. And it really, you know, sort of the pieces started to connect when we spent the Shabbat up there. They had like a Shabbaton for all the people that are working on the various literature projects of the, you know, whether Dine Halacha and the different languages and some other things that they're working on. And you go to he gives a shiur on Shabbat afternoon. So first of all, it's a community of 300, 400 families, maybe more, 500 families. On Shabbat afternoon, there's like, on Shabbat day, the course of Shabbat, there's only like 30 shiurim for all ages, for men, for women, for teens, for kids, it's wild, like just the whole day. And it's capped off by, they daven mincha early, and then there's about an hour that he gives a shiur, and you know, they daven marav a little bit late. During that hour, he gives his shiur, and that's sort of where he works out a lot of the things that he's going to end up writing about. That's like his testing ground. They hear it there first, and the place is packed. It's the men's section and the women's section. Packed. And it's really, it's an impressive thing. You know, it sort of harkens back to, you know, they used to say about the Ben Ish Chai, Rabbi Yosef Chaim of Baghdad, who lived a little over 100 years ago. He used to give a drasha on Shabbat afternoon. that went for about 3 hours. Right? This is pre-air conditioning. In freaking Baghdad. Okay? And we went for 3 hours. Of course, it's also in the era before television. This was also entertainment. And the book, Ben Ish Chai, if you look at the book, Ben Ish Chai, it's arranged by Parsha, because that's what he used to do. It was based on his drashot, where he would go and he would weave together halacha and agada and ideas, and he would weave it together, and that's what he would speak about for 3 hours in the afternoon. And you see also that that's also that commitment to Torah study specifically on Shabbos also comes out through that. So that's another piece. So I mentioned earlier his approach to birth control and family planning. And there also, he looks at career as a very important factor. And he looks at, he's trying to balance, and he's trying to offer guidance, and he does, let's say, it's differentiated. There are things that he says that for people who are like this, maybe they should do this. For people who are like that, maybe they should do that. He's not pro-birth control in the sense of he's reluctant to say, oh yeah, it's okay. But he says, first of all, any couple after a kid can go on birth control for 2 years. And he talks about people that if there's at the beginning of marriage, it might be good to go on birth control so that, you know, until the relationship stabilizes. That they make sure that there's a steady, really solid foundation before starting to build the family. And he talks about, he says that even though he's against indefinite birth control, like let's say there's a couple that wants to get married and they're very young, and he says that if the choice is between the couple getting married now and not starting a family right away, or the couple getting married later and starting a family right away, it's better for the couple to get married now and not start the family right away. So, that's a chiddush. But the pressures that he's talking about are generally the pressures of where you have the, on one hand, a young couple, often, they're still in school. Because if people would wait until they're done with school and done with graduate school and done with residencies and internships and all the things that are necessary, especially in Israel where things are actually, they happen a little bit later. But even here, yeah, everybody knows, you know, undergraduate is just at step one. And, you know, having just a bachelor's, that's not where we're, you know, we don't know what we're going to do with our lives yet. We're going to go to graduate school. And that'll, so if people in Israel, for somebody to become a doctor, let's say, it's not, you know, they're not going to start making a real living until they're well into their 30s. You're also, I don't know how it works, but it could be a while. And he's not in favor of, he doesn't think people should be waiting that long. They're, you know, they're, it's based on Gemara, it's based on general, human maturity, that you reach a certain stage of maturity around in the early 20s, thinks that's the right time. But then you have, what about career? So he says, you know, if you look at the way that he builds, this hasn't been published yet. It's hopefully this summer. If you look at the way that he structures it, in Simchat Abayit chapter 5, he talks about the proper age for marriage, of marriage for men, the proper age of marriage for women. And then he talks about the responsibility, mutual responsibility. Couples have a certain responsibility to themselves. But then, their families and society has a certain responsibility as well. So, in his yeshuv, for example, childcare is more heavily subsidized than elsewhere. Right. They want to make it possible for young couples to start building their families, and at the same time continue with their schooling or, you know, have, you know, build their careers while they have young children. So in order to do that, you need to have a strong social, you need to have a strong social basis. You need to have a strong, a social environment that's going to encourage that sort of thing. And I think that it's important for first the immediate family, i.e. the parents of the couple, to do, you know, to contribute toward that. And then also that society should. But that he's not, it's not like one of these things like, you know, oh yeah, like I'm supporting my kids in Kollel indefinitely. I'm supporting my kids in Kollel forever. He's like, no. Somebody's in school, somebody's in, you know, they're, it's not indefinite, and it, you're paying it forward, meaning they should be doing it for the next generation as well. Right? That this is how society should run, that you know, parents should think about supporting their children while their children are in those early years where they have all of these pressures of marriage and family and career. And it's within that context that he begins to talk about. And then the last piece, the last piece that I like talking about is, it's actually not in the source sheet. He's really anti playing games on Shabbos. Right? He's like, he's the most mafia position that I've ever seen about, like, building, like, you know, using the couch cushions to build, like, a little fort. He's super anti. Like, playing games like Monopoly or Lego or, like, we know that, okay, there's always, you know, oh, Monopoly on Shabbos, you're not allowed to play that because of this. And he usually, in these kinds of questions, he just adopts a very machmir position. Now, if you look in the footnotes, he's always like, yeah, the truth of the matter is that most poskim say that it's okay. But he's like, but you shouldn't be playing Scrabble or Monopoly or Lego or building forts on Shabbos, because you should be learning, right? And even kids, like, okay, fine, so you don't say anything to your kids while they're building the fort, but once your kid gets to be like 8 or 9 or 10 years old, then you should be learning with your kids, right? You know, pull out a Mishnah and learn with your kids. Why are you playing these games with your kids? Because he ends up taking a machmir approach, because it's the flip side of his ideas about learning on Shabbos, right? Shabbos should be spent learning. If you have free time, you shouldn't be playing, you know, what my kids like saying, playing, say, you shouldn't be playing Settlers. Maybe he should. Maybe he would make an exception for Settlers. You shouldn't be playing games. You should be learning, and your kids should be learning. You should be modeling for your kids that this is what they should be doing on Shabbos. So if we take, you know, talk about Lego, the Lego is really a good metaphor for what he's trying to do, I think, with this whole project, is that, yeah, if I said to you at the beginning of this year that, yes, Eliezer Melamed's approach is to learning on Shabbos and playing with Lego on Shabbos, and his attitudes towards birth control and his attitudes toward Maser Sheni and Maser Ani are all linked somehow, we'll be like, what are you talking about? Like, those are very different areas of halacha. But you see that in each of those cases, the halachic position that he ends up articulating comes from this idea, right, emerges from his vision of what a society or what a civilization should look like, that part of it is how families are formed, how families grow. Part of it is career. How are we supposed to invest in a career? And how are we supposed to build our lives around Torah study? And he's trying to articulate this balance between all of these different pressures, between Torah and career and family. And he thinks it's important to have a productive career, meaning he thinks that, we saw that already with Maser Ani, it's important to have the dignity of earning your own living. And so and that's going to affect how he thinks about family planning. And that's going to affect how he thinks about what we're supposed to be doing during the week, which in turn affects what we're supposed to be doing on Shabbat. And it's going to affect how we plan out our families while we're trying to establish careers and that's going to in turn have an effect on what he, you know, what he says about how he thinks about birth control. So, returning to the original question, so I put it back to you: is this Zionist halacha? On one hand, I don't think he articulates any position that's completely out of left field. There's nothing that he says, and you do have poskim that will do something like that. Well, now that we're in Eretz Yisrael, it sometimes weirds me out, like how things become halachic considerations. Like today, there's a lot of debate about Har HaBayit, whether or not one is allowed to go onto Har HaBayit. And sometimes you have people saying that yes, we should permit going onto Har HaBayit because it's an expression of Jewish sovereignty over Har HaBayit. Since when is expression of sovereignty a halachic consideration? Like we have people like, you know, ribonut and ribonus. You don't have that in halachic discourse, and it's entering halachic discourse. So that's like a specifically Zionist world. And without judging, you know, I have my critique of it, but you can leave my critique of that aside. To like, okay, there you have a real, almost a Zionist consideration becomes a halachic consideration. Here, I mean, almost explicitly, here he's not articulating positions that are unfounded. You know, everything that he's saying can be found in other precedents. Learning 6 hours on Shabbos, he's got plenty of precedents for it. And the birth control, he's got plenty of precedents for it. And the Lego, even, he's got precedents for it. Maybe the precedents aren't about Lego, they're about other interlocking toys. But he's got precedents. But the way that he puts it together is something that articulates what, you know, the way that he thinks is a Jewish, I keep on going back to that word, a Jewish civilization should look like. It's a civilizational view, it's a civilizational approach. So in that sense, I think it's very deeply Zionistic, because he's not thinking about, as an individual or even on a communal level, this is what our policy should be, this is what we should be doing, but he's thinking much more globally, like how does the Torah envision our building a civilization? And the halacha is a reflection of how the Torah thinks, or how we interpret the Torah as building a civilization. So in that sense, I think that it's, not only is it deeply Zionistic, but it's very, it's aspirationally Zionistic, right? It's a Zionist vision that we can, first of all, we can critique, we can say that, okay, I want to articulate it a little bit differently, but it's also one that I think that that's something that we need to be thinking about. I actually, before Yom HaAtzmaut, I like reading anti-Zionist. I'm not talking about like the junk that you find, and, you know, I'm not talking about, I like looking at New York Times political cartoons. I mean, I like reading like the Satmar Rebbe or Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, right? Because it was never a foregone conclusion. It was not a foregone conclusion that this is the right way to go, that this is the right way to be. So I think it's important to get back to first principles, that on some level, this experiment of the State of Israel is this amazing experiment in, okay, after all these years of being essentially hosted by another civilization, we have... We're living in a generation of the two great exceptions, right? And the two great exceptions are Israel and the United States. Israel and that, for the first time in centuries, we're actually building a Jewish civilization. And the United States is exceptional in the sense that in the United States, the Jews of the United States, American Jews, are not guests, right? We're as much American as any other American. Right, and so that there's not the sense of we're a tolerated minority. No, it's the sense that we're part of this experiment of America. And I think that's those two great experiments can inform a lot of the relationship and a lot of the tensions between the relationship of the two communities and the relationship between the two communities. Because they're both so exceptional, but even if, as we appreciate what America offers us, Israel is also offering us that opportunity to be part of that civilization. And Rav Melamed, through the vehicle of halacha,
is articulating his vision of what that civilization should be and what it should look like. And so in that sense, yeah, it's an aspirational, civilizational, first principles of Zionism approach. And so I think that it's something that I look for now whenever I'm learning, and I read a lot of his stuff, whenever I see what he's trying to do, whenever I learn what he's writing, you know, that's, you start to see how it all fits into a bigger picture. All right. More questions or just schmooze or?
Answer
your
question. I'm
sure.
Curious. Okay, so this, like, I see what you're saying about how it's, like, all connected, but it's more implicit, but he has some of his books that are, like, a little more explicit, like, Fanbaharis, he talks about, like, terrorists, or talks about not buying from, like, Arab stores or things like that. So I guess two parts, like, for those, I guess, do you see that, like, even stronger as part of, like, a more Zionist halakha? And then secondly, has that been translated into English? And if yes, is there, like, an American reaction to those
books? Okay. Okay. Ha'am Baharetz. Have you seen the maps in Ha'am Baharetz? Ha'am Baharetz has maps, like, there's like a globe. It's almost like, yeah, there's a machlok of exactly what the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael are. And there's like, he brings this opinion that the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael basically go from the Euphrates River in Iraq all the way to like the Nile River. It's like the whole place is like, what the heck? This cannot get out. At some point, somebody did start translating it a number of years ago. Fortunately, the translation was atrocious. And, you know, they sent it to me and asked me for my opinion. And I was like, oh, this is, it is. I didn't just say it. It is a terrible, terrible translation. And it's also like, you know, like the book on Shemitah, it's not coming out in English anytime soon just because there's not that much of a market for it. So I haven't gone through all of Ha'am Baharetz Kaseder. I do know that when it comes to a few things. First of all, he has plans when he finishes all of Penina Halacha for Jews, he's going to write a volume of Penina Halacha on the seven mitzvot of Bnei Noach. And I can't wait to translate that into English. And I can't wait till like the entire state of Texas buys themselves coffees. That's going to be great. Okay. I'll give three examples about three different non-Jewish religious communities and his relationships with them. Okay, you know where his yeshuv is. It's called Har Bracha, because it's on Har Grizim, right, overlooking Shem. Right? Read about it at the beginning of Devarim, that Har Grizim and Har Eval are these two mountains on either side of Shechem. So he's, the Grizim was the Bracha, was the mountain of Bracha. I'm sorry, yeah, Grizim was the mountain of Bracha, Eval was the mountain of Klala. So he's on Har Grizim. Now there's a community of Samaritans on Har Grizim. Right, the famous, little chef the Korban Pesach every year. And some years it's not at the same time as our Pesach, so all these Jews go up to like look at what a Korban Pesach might have looked like. So the access to their community is through Har Bracha, and they have an interesting relationship with Har Bracha, meaning they shop at Har Bracha. They're almost like this conduit. Whenever there's like business deals and transactions and even meetings between Jews in Har Bracha and Arabs in Shechem, it can take place in that Samaritan community because it's almost like a buffer. It's almost like a neutral territory in between. I have a friend who lives in Har Bracha who is an avid unicyclist. Don't ask. He also makes his own wine and beer. He's like one of these. You think you know him? He's a unicyclist. He's on it. You know. You think you know? You don't know.
Not someone who makes his own wine.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that do unicycle. That unicycle, and he unicycles to work. Okay, I'm like.
strange dude. Interesting dude. Strange dude. So he was like on some sort of chat group or Facebook group for unicyclists, and you know, his location pops up as being, you know, Nablus West Bank. So somebody else is like, oh, I'm also from Nablus, we should get together and unicycle together. But he's Jewish settler, Arab, whatever. So they get together in the Samaritan village so that they could like unicycle together. Okay? It's a bizarre thing that, you know, they should have, like, you know, they should bring the birth work trips there to, like, watch the two of them unicycle.
Let our people know.
What? Together it's a bicycle. A tandem bicycle.
A tandem unicycle.
A tandem unicycle. That'd be cool.
So is that like a bicycle, but for two people?
A tandem bicycle, I guess, but I don't think there could be a tandem unicycle.
One wait, what were the other... What were the...
Yeah, it would be...
One person does one pedal, one person does the other.
Yeah, it would be weird to have a... You know, I guess it would be like one of those... like those
like old, a seesaw.
Yeah. You know, like those one-car train things where like people are like... Just with one wheel instead of four...
Wait, what were the other communities besides for the Samaritans? Sorry. I'm interested in it.
The other one, okay. Now, and this also, by the way, fits with his broader worldview. It's very much a part of it. So in order for it to build a community, you need affordable housing. People want to be able to have space. Okay, you need affordable housing. So the cheaper labor is Muslim labor, especially when you're in, you know, in the Shomron. Most of the Yishuvim in his area, they will not hire Arab labor. You know, Avodah Yehudit, Avodah Ivrit, which I think was one of the gargantuan mistakes that the early Zionist movement, labor Zionist movement made, was this insistence on Avodah Ivrit, this idea of like, yeah, they were socialists and communists, so it was like, we can't just be management. We have to be getting down and dirty and working the land ourselves. And even though it was only a small percentage of people that did that, it created an impression amongst the Arab population, who were mostly fellahin peasants, that it's not just that the Jews want to come and buy up land, they want to completely replace us. They want to be the labor also. The first Aliyah, they came and they bought places. A lot of the labor was Arab labor. So the second Aliyah was like, no, we're socialists. We're going to do the labor ourselves. That really spooked the Palestinian population. And I think it's just, they didn't think about how it would be perceived because they were thinking like, oh no, we're going to be socialist. But, you know, had the Jews come in and like, we're going to be in the cities and we're going to be the accountants, and you guys can continue to work the land like you've been doing for hundreds of years, it might have been a completely different story. Who knows? When it comes to Avodah Aravit, so that became, you know, so none of the places around them, like the places like Itamar and Yitzhar, if they're building, it's Jewish labor only. Rav Malamed's like, why? We want housing to be affordable. We want. Hey, what are you worried about? Like this, having Arabs who are cheaper labor come and build our houses, it actually makes our houses more affordable. It makes it more feasible for people in our communities to buy, and you know, to buy houses. So why would I be against that? It's actually helping Yishuv Haaretz. So Arabs are making a living from it. Great, right? And it actually they won't hire local Arabs. Not because they're against hiring local Arabs, but because the local Palestinians, if they would work building the yeshuv, they would be putting themselves at risk. So they bring Palestinian laborers from further south to do some of the building in Har Bracha, to do some of the building in Har Bracha. So, what is that? What does that mean? I would be lying if I told you that I agree with a lot of his politics. I think that some of his politics are deeply problematic, especially in Ha'am B'Haaretz. That's the book that causes me more discomfort, political discomfort, than any other. And at the same time, even in that book, his pragmatism does come out, meaning he's thinking things through through a pragmatic lens, even when it comes to issues of Jews and Muslims or Jews and Palestinians in the territories. So I still think that the book probably shouldn't be translated into English, because I think that the audience for it is very limited, and the potential whatever. But at the same time, and even though I disagree with his politics on a lot of things, I do think that his approach ultimately is one that's, number one, pragmatic, and number two, humane. So I think we'll leave it at that. The third group that I want to mention is Christians, American Christians. There's a group of American Christians that comes to Har Bracha every year in order to help with the grape harvest. Apparently, that's what it says in the book of Isaiah. I'll take their word for it. It's the book of Isaiah. I mean, other than evangelical Christians. You know how they used to say in Israel that, like, oh, in Israel, even, like, the milkman knows Shas, and even the cleaning lady knows Tanakh, and, like, it's true, except that the cleaning lady is a Pentecostal, and that's why she knows. at least in Israel today. So, and he has sort of worked out, because he has this relationship with them, he's worked out this whole pragmatic approach to, okay, how are we dealing with these groups? On one hand, we want to use their support. On the other hand, he has very specific conditions, under what conditions this can happen, and under what, but it's a very positive experience for all involved, apparently. There was a long article about it in Haaretz last year, and the Haaretz readers didn't know what to do with it. Because, like, on one hand, it's like Haaretz thought it was a terrible thing that Americans are coming to help with, the occupation by picking grapes in Samaria. But on the other hand, it was like there was this real relationship that was developing, and it wasn't based on, oh yeah, we're really trying to proselytize you secretly. No, it was like a healthy relationship, and they didn't exactly know what to do with that. So again, I don't think he set out to articulate views on these sorts of things, but it came up, and so he went through it, and he came up with this approach for his community. And it's something that seems to be working. So one of the things that I most appreciate about him, as a person, is that he's really non-dogmatic, pragmatic. I'll give you another example. This is another one with non-Jews. When we were first discussing the translation, when I came in, we changed. There were a couple of books that had been translated. There was no uniformity of spelling. There was no uniformity of style. So we wanted to tighten that up, and we wanted to think about markets, who's our potential market. So I suggested, maybe think about, when translating it into English, translating it into Ashkenazis, right? Not with the laws of Shabbos, not the laws of Shabbat. And one of his students is an American guy. He stands up and he's like, "What the heck are you talking about? How can you be?" And Romano's like, "Sit down, shut up. Let's hear what he has to say," right? And he wasn't like, "Yeah, okay, I speak like this, but let's hear what he has to say." What's the market? My grandparents spoke like that. I don't have an ideological opposition to translating Shin Bez Sav as Shabbos instead of Shabbat. So let's hear what he has to. Let's think about it. He's open to it. So.
And I like that about him. Like, when a new device comes out, he'll get himself one, and he'll, like, tinker around with it in his kitchen to be like, okay, can I get this salad grind maker something that you can use on Shabbos or not? He is, you know, he's curious, he has a strong empirical streak, and he's not afraid to come out with his own opinion. So, with all of the, you know, acknowledging that there are disagreements and that there are, he has a political ideology that's, and sometimes, you know, I alluded to it in his economics also, and economic ideas that are, you can take issue with. I'm fascinated by how he's working it out, and you see that it is, that it's resonating. And I think that the phenomenon Bigadol is a very positive phenomenon. Right? That he's a really, he's making a really, really positive contribution to halacha and to, you know, how Jews think about these kinds of things. I hope that's an adequate answer.